Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Following days of decisions from other nations, including China, Mexico, the European Union, and Canada, yesterday, President Trump announced that the United States had abruptly reversed course and grounded the Boeing 737 MAX 8 and 9 aircraft.
Boeing is an incredible company. They are working very, very hard right now. And hopefully they'll very quickly come up with the answer. But until they do, the planes are grounded.
The FAA says its decision was driven by new evidence of possible similarities between two deadly crashes in the past 5 months, Ethiopian Air Flight 302 on Sunday and Lion Air Flight 610 last October. More than 340 people died in the crashes, so there are urgent questions surrounding these aircraft for passenger safety, for major U.S. carriers, and for Boeing. We'll talk with the former chairman of the NTSB and a veteran pilot as well. So this hour on Point, next steps investigating the Boeing 737. Max. And you can join us. What is your question about one of Boeing's fastest-selling, most profitable aircraft, about the investigation or how regulators have handled the decision to ground the 737 MAX? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. We're going to start today in Washington with Lori Aretani. She's transportation reporter for The Washington Post, covering airports and airlines. We've got links to her reporting at OnPointRadio.org. Lori, welcome to the program.
Hi, Meghna. Thank you for having me on.
All right. So I want to first start with a little bit of what acting FAA Administrator Daniel Elwell said yesterday. He appeared on CNBC, and he said that the FAA, in making this decision to ground the 737 MAX, didn't do it because of global pressure around making this action and the fact that other nations had done something similar in previous days.
We are a data-driven, action-oriented agency, and we don't make decisions about grounding aircraft or regulating or even shut down decisions for airports or aircraft without actionable data. And in this case, the actionable data didn't arrive until today. I can't speak to the motivations of the other countries, but for us, it was an independent decision.
That's Acting FAA Administrator Daniel Elwell. So, Lori, what was that other data? Were those other data that the FAA recently got its hands on?
They have new information that tells them there are some similarities in sort of the vertical variations between the two flights. The data, they'd received the data early on, but Elwell announced yesterday that they'd been able to refine it. They'll need to do more work on that, but there were enough similarities that they felt it was important for them to ground the planes and wait to see what the investigation could tell us about this. You're right in that the U.S. was the last. They followed shortly after Canada. Japan also announced that they'd be grounding the planes. Boeing continues to emphasize that they believe that the planes are safe to operate, but they are cooperating with the FAA and will continue to cooperate with the FAA on the investigation. We know that the black boxes, the data recorder and the voice recorders have both been recovered. They are in Paris now where they'll be analyzed, and hopefully that will give us more of a sense of what may have happened and will help us understand the similarities and will help us get to a cause that can make sure that these planes, which are the most popular plane worldwide, will be safe to fly.
So I'm seeing here, though, that part of the reason why the FAA was waiting to get more data is, did they end up looking at information that was given to them, or they worked with a private aerospace company in Virginia that was able to get that more refined information?
Yes, that's right. They said they had some initial information, but they've been able to refine what they had. There's a private company out in Northern Virginia that was able to help refine the information and tell them, give them a little more detail about these variations. There were accounts about, you know, both planes crashed shortly after takeoff, and there were accounts that they had difficulty maintaining and gaining altitude. There was sort of a seesaw. You know, you really feel for those passengers that were aboard as the pilot struggled to maintain and gain control.
Okay, so here on that point, again, is Acting Administrator Daniel Elwell on CNBC talking about this new evidence that the FAA received yesterday.
The initial track that we got on Sunday and Monday morning was only 3 minutes long, the first 3 minutes of the flight. The new track data we looked at was almost for the entire length of the flight. Also, the evidence that we discovered on the ground was even further evidence that the flight was very similar to Lion Air.
That's Acting FAA Administrator Daniel Elwell. So, Lori Aretani, I mean, I think the first and most urgent question that most passengers have right now is, if they're so similar, these flight paths, how much can we tell about what the causes of the crashes were?
I think that's why the black boxes and the investigation that's going on the ground are going to be key. They're going to tell us more. You know, there's a lot of talk about these angle of attack sensors that are on the plane's nose that tell you where the nose is pointing. There were concerns when this is a new version of the 737. The engines are positioned differently on the plane, so there's a concern that the planes could stall as they work to gain altitude. So this computer system was put into place to sort of help safeguard against that. Some pilots in the U.S. have raised concerns about whether they were properly trained on this, whether pilots were notified about how to disable the system or deal with the system if it kicked in and they needed to take over flying.
Mm. So just to let folks know, I mean, as you mentioned, Boeing has said that it has confidence in the aircraft, but of course they support, as they say, quote, this proactive step out of an abundance of caution. Boeing in a statement said, we're doing everything we can to understand the cause of the accidents in partnership with investigators, deploy safety enhancements, and ensure this does not happen again. But since this latest crash happened in Ethiopia, the investigation is going to be led by Ethiopian authorities, is it not?
Yes, it is. They're taking the lead. But the FAA and the National Transportation Safety Board, which is the main agency here in the U.S. that investigates crashes, are also there helping. I believe Boeing also has a team on the ground there looking into the cause as well.
Okay. So, Lori Aretani, stand by for just one second, because I want to bring into the conversation Jim Hall. He joins us from Signal Mountain, Tennessee. He was chairman of the National Transportation Safety Board. He served in that position from 1994 to 2001. Jim Hall, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Hall, what do you think about the fact that the FAA finally came around and grounded the Boeing 737 MAX 8 and 9? Do you wish they had done it sooner?
Well, I'm pleased that the decision was made by the president to ground the aircraft. The FAA, unfortunately, I think, did not represent aviation safety or the public interest well in this situation. And if you might recall, my first call was to Boeing, because Boeing Airline has more factual information on the operation of the 737 MAX than even our own FAA. And it's been very silent on the facts that would have led to a decision on what to do about the airworthiness of this aircraft. So, I think Congress now needs to take a close look at the certification process.
Right. So we have members of Congress who are saying that they are going to take a look into this. But help us understand what you just said, Jim Hall, that Boeing has more information about the 737 MAX than the FAA does. What do you mean?
Well, as you just put in your report, the FAA, it appears, is relying on an outside company for additional expertise and information. I don't know why we don't have that internally to the Federal Aviation Administration. And with Boeing Aircraft Corporation, they have contracts with most of their airlines, many of them, for real-time transmission of data on the operation of the flight. So what we don't know, and would hopefully learn through hearings in Congress on the certification process, is what Boeing knew and when it knew it in regard to, you know, any potential flight control problems on this aircraft, and whether there were any indicators of that in the first Lion Air accident that should have led to an immediate grounding of the aircraft at that time.
Now, the certification process you're talking about, that's the certification that the aircraft is safe to fly?
Yes.
Okay, so I just, you know, like this is a very complex world, so I want to be sure we're understanding what you're saying correctly. So are you...
It's a complex world, but if you put safety first, it doesn't become very complex. And when you have an event that loses the lives of over 100 people, that's time, even if it's on a foreign soil, for the manufacturer and our Federal Aviation Administration to move as quickly and rapidly as possible in the interest of aviation safety.
Now, a couple of years ago, you wrote, if I remember correctly, in the New York Times, that when the FAA made this change to the certification system, that essentially, engineering experts were, selected by Boeing and designated by the FAA to be part of the certification process? The implication in your mind that, Boeing was essentially self-certifying its own aircraft?
That's correct. And as a result, since that has occurred, we've had two situations, one with the batteries on the 787, resulted in a grounding of a Boeing aircraft until a solution or a correction was found, and now this event. So it begs question whether we have a certification process in which the manufacturer can sidestep important safety concerns.
Huh. Lori Aretani, we've got about 30 seconds before we have to take a quick break here, but what's your reaction to what Jim Hall is saying? He's the former chairman of the NTSB.
Well, Jim is someone who has been part of these investigations, and he knows the ins and outs. There are concerns about the certification process. The 737, there have been reports that pilots didn't have the training that maybe some would have liked to have had.
Okay, so Lori Aretani and Jim Hall, stand by for just a second. We're talking about next steps in investigating the Boeing 737 MAX 8 and 9 aircraft. When we come back, we'll talk to a veteran airline pilot who's got over 18,000 flight hours on American Airlines, amongst others. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about next steps in the investigation into the Boeing 737 MAX 8 and 9 aircraft. As you know, yesterday the United States reversed course and decided to ground the aircraft after many other nations had done following those two deadly crashes in the past 5 months. Here's Ethiopian Airlines CEO Tewolde Gebremariam telling CNN on Tuesday that Sunday's crash of the Ethiopian Airlines flight showed similarities to the Lion Air crash in Indonesia last October.
We believe the similarities are substantial. They're both the same airplane model, brand new airplanes. And also the flights were very short, I think 8 minutes in the case of Lion Air and 6 minutes flight in our case.
That's the Ethiopian Airlines CEO. Lori Aretani joins us today. She's a transportation reporter for The Washington Post. And Jim Hall is also with us. He's a former chairman of the National Transportation Safety Board. He was in that position from 1994 to 2001. Lori Aretani, I just want to ask you a really quick question here. Because before the break, you heard Jim Hall say that the president made the decision to ground these aircraft. Is that true? Who made this decision?
The FAA has told us that this was acting administrator Elwell's decision.
Okay, but
that's what they've told us,
but
the first
word of it we heard was from the president of the United States.
Yes, it was.
That seems a little unusual.
Yes, it is unusual, but we are in an unusual time in the White House these days.
Okay. All right. Well, so I just wanted to double check on that because you never know. You're right in this day and age. So Laurie and Jim, hang on here for just a second because I do want to introduce Captain Larry Rooney into the conversation. He is president of the Coalition of Airline Pilots Association, a trade association that represents over 30,000 professional airline pilots at 14 airlines. He's a captain and check airman at American Airlines with over 18,000 flight hours. He's also former chairman of the Accident Investigation Committee and vice chairman of the Training Committee at the U.S. Airline Pilots Association. Captain Rooney, welcome back to the program.
Hello, Meghna. Thanks for having me on today.
So, first of all, I presume you've flown these aircraft.
I have flown earlier versions of the 737, but I currently do not fly the 737 MAX series.
Okay, I'm guessing you know the sort of ins and outs of what pilots who are behind the stick there are facing in the cockpit.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, so can you tell us a little bit, just explain to us what the, it seems like one of the system that's under a lot of scrutiny right now. What is it, what does it do, and how do pilots use it?
Well, it's called the Maneuvering Characteristics Augmentation System, short for MCAS. It's probably what you've heard it referred to by most people that talk about this system. And basically, what it was designed to do is to emulate the flying characteristics of the previous 737 in order for the pilots that would be flying this to have a similar type rating when they were training on the airplane, and to make it as seamless a transition as possible so that the airplane would feel and fly like the airplane that they were used to. In order to do that, though, because of the design changes to this airplane, they actually added larger engines, mounted them differently on the pylons and on the airplane, and as such, they had to kind of re-engineer the ability for the airplane to control pitch if it got into a high nose attitude where an aerodynamic stall would be a possibility. There had to be some way to help get the nose down because the previous design was inadequate in order to do so because of the additional size of the airplane and where the weight and the CG that the engines now created would have resulted in. So as a result, they came up with what they call the Maneuvering Characteristics Augmentation System. And what it was designed to do, or what it is designed to do, is to help the pilots to recover from a high angle of attack situation where they need to get the nose down. You know, kind of like think of it as a teeter-totter. Mm-hmm. We've got a heavier kid on one side, a lighter one on the other. You've got to be able to balance that. And the ability to get the nose down, meaning the top of the teeter-totter or lighter kid is, you have to have the ability to be able to make that change. So this system was designed to do that, and what it does is it provides down trim on the stabilizer in order to get the nose to be able to move downward. And the system operates; it basically trims at a quarter degree a second over 10 seconds to provide 2.5 degrees of down pitch moment to assist the pilot in recovering the airplane in a stall situation.
Okay, so you heard Lori Aretani earlier in the program say that, you know, we've been hearing reports of pilots struggling to keep the nose of these aircraft up. I mean, if you were in that situation, what would you do? Does it make sense that might happen?
Well, there are ways around it. I mean, the original concern that we had was that a lot of these airplanes, as the technology increases on them, the pilots may or may not have had that information shared with them. I mean, many times the corporations that buy the airplanes, that information wasn't shared with them by the manufacturer. And that was the concern that we had with this particular design, was because it was something that was put on the airplane that had never been telegraphed to the crews. Knowing that it's on the airplane today, we do have the ability to be able to manage this situation if, in fact, it presents itself. There are three ways to disarm the system if the pilots, you know, are aware of those three methods. Our crews have all been trained on that at this time. They're pretty aware of how to get out of this if, in fact, it activates.
Captain Rooney, can we just talk about this for a second? Because I want to be sure I heard you correctly. This is something else that has been reported, that Boeing put this system on aircraft and didn't necessarily notify pilots that they had made this change seems like a pretty critical piece of information for the men and women flying these aircraft.
Well, absolutely. I mean, that was always the pushback that, you know, we felt as professional pilots that we should have been informed of these changes. In Boeing's defense, they, you know, claim that there's hundreds and hundreds of these changes that take place when they make design changes to the aircraft, and for them to telegraph all of them, you know, might be too much. It would be sensory overload information-wise to the pilot group. You know, as a professional pilot, obviously, I want as much complete information as I can get. We are obviously the, you know, last line of defense. You know, nothing is more important to a professional aviator than the safety of his craft and the passengers that he's been entrusted with.
Well, Jim Hall, let me turn back to you here for a second, because as you, I'm sure, as well know, earlier this week, the Dallas Morning News reported that they looked into the NASA database in which pilots can anonymously provide feedback information about the aircraft they're flying. And they found at least 5 instances in which U.S. pilots were complaining about problems they had with the 737 MAX 8 and 9, at least the MAX 8. I guess I'm just, as a passenger, I'm trying to wrap my head around the fact that Boeing can make changes to aircraft and not necessarily report them to the pilots. Who's in charge of deciding what information they must report?
Well, first of all, let me say the NASA database was created as a result of a recommendation out of the NTSB. Second, it's on a checklist of things that our investigators look at once we begin the investigation of an accident like this, because the pilot reports are extremely important. So that begs the question, if we're data-driven, this data was available, and why then, after the Lion Air accident, didn't Boeing or the FAA take steps to ground this aircraft and have a retraining to be sure that all pilots did have this critical information? So the sensory overload argument went away, in my opinion, at that point.
Hmm. Captain Rooney, do you want to respond to Jim Hall?
Well, as far as the training that we have now on the airplane, I mean, the crews have all been, you know, brought into the equation as to what this, you know, quote-unquote deficiency, if you want to claim it to be that, is. So they know about these characteristics, and they know that the way that they get out of the situation, for the fact that it does occur to them. You know, in deference to Mr. Hall, yes, I agree that the systems, the safety systems that are in there, many of them, you know, as a result of the hard work done by the National Transportation Safety Board, of which he served, we have systems that are actually in place. One of them is the Flight Operations Quality Assurance group, and these airplanes are constantly sending data to the corporations, so that we have a way to monitor, you know, these airplanes, and at a tremendous amount of data is produced on a daily, weekly, monthly, yearly basis to be able to keep tabs on, you know, how our airplanes are performing in the fleets that we fly. In addition to that, we have Aviation Safety Action Program, where the crews get to self-disclose information that they might feel that, you know, provide safety deficiencies that the FAA, in concert with the corporation and the pilots' unions, look at in order to be able to mitigate safety concerns that might exist out there, and in such a way that the crews are the crews are willing to be able to share that information.
Yeah. But Captain Rooney, I mean, you heard Jim Hall earlier say exactly what you just mentioned, that this real-time flight information is being sent to Boeing. But he was saying that he doesn't think the FAA basically has the staff or the capacity to adequately oversee Boeing in the interest of the American public. Boeing has control of the information, as you just said. I mean, what do you think about that?
Well, I think, you know, as the final end users of the product, I think that we have faith in the system, in the FAA and the NTSB, but I will defer to Mr. Hall, having been serving in that role. It's certainly, not necessarily my area of expertise. We'd like to believe that the FAA and the NTSB, as a given, have, you know, safety as their overriding concern. It's what we believe, but I will defer to Mr. Hall as the insider with information that I would not be privy to.
Okay. So, Jim Hall, hang on here for just a second, because I do want to bring Lori Aratani back into this conversation, because, you know, we're focusing a little bit about, obviously, about what's going to happen now. But there was that Lion Air crash 5 months ago, right, Lori? So, I mean, can you just remind us what steps were taken in between, you know, 5 months ago and Sunday's Ethiopian air crash, and why, what steps were taken, first of all?
So about 9 days after that crash, I guess a little over a week after that crash, Boeing had sent out information letting people know about this software system and its existence. The FAA had also issued what they call an emergency airworthiness directive, warning airlines and operators that this could – that there was a potential that this system could trigger and it could send the plane down. They had a different way that they put it, but to make sure that the manuals, the flight manuals, had information about how they could disable the system. There, I think shortly after, I think on Monday, it's hard to keep track because this has all been so fast moving.
Right.
The FAA had, when they reiterated their support in the plane, had also noted that Boeing was going to release a software update in April that would impact these planes. There was a report, I believe it was in the Wall Street Journal, that
That's right.
said that the government shutdown may have had played a role in delaying the ability to get this stuff out and up and out to the airlines.
Yeah, let me just fill in. So the Wall Street Journal reported that the government shutdown may have delayed the release of the software patch by some 5 weeks, because I think Boeing originally had said they wanted it out by January.
January, yes.
Yeah, the FAA just denies that. They said the government shutdown had nothing to do with it. So, but anyway, so Lori and Jim and Captain Rooney, hang on here for just a second, because I do want to get some callers in here. So let's go to Joe, who's calling from Port Richey, Florida. Joe, you're on the air.
Hi. You know, as being a former NASA technical director and 20 years working for the government in the aerospace industry, I have an awful lot to say. You know, we've seen this problem in the F-111s in the back day when we're developing the ground terrain following radar, and the software, when it loses sense of the ground, was supposed to automatically pop up and gain altitude to save the pilot from running into the ground. And it was a software anomaly that was led to the aircraft popping down and actually crashing into the ground. And then we had several failures and loss of life in that. One of the things that causes this to happen is the overabundance and the excessive use of probability analysis during qualification and testing, and too much segregation of the software, testing it in little tiny pieces instead of as a whole. And so this probability, being able to talk your way out of a failure, a critical failure, is what leads to these aircraft ending up certified and being out there with anomalies that were never resolved, critical anomalies like this one here. That needs to stop in the system. When there's a critical anomaly that can lead to loss of life, there should not be allowed some probability analysis to meet qualification and then receive certification.
Hey, Joe, can I just jump in here? Yeah. Joe, let me just jump in here for a second, because I want to ask you quickly. So are you suggesting, given your experience as a NASA technical director, that at least for civil aviation, that we ought to be completely redesigning how we do these analysis rather than looking for individual probabilities? It sounded like you were calling for a whole-scale rethink.
Well, what I'm saying is that the overuse of probability analysis during qualification failures is something we call failure modes effects analysis. When they have a failure in the lab or in the field and testing during qualification aircraft, and they can't explain it, they wind up doing these probability analysis rather than getting to root cause and actually finding it. So what you have is an aircraft that gets qualified and certified with problems that are not really resolve.
Yeah, I got it now, Joe. That's really interesting, Joe. Thank you so much. So probability analysis being used in term with these possible failures instead of root cause analysis. That's fascinating. Jim Hall, do you have a thought about that?
No, I think he's made an excellent point, and one I hope that will be examined as a result of this going forward. You know, on just a simple scale that most of your listeners can understand, you know, you used to have requirement for emergency evacuation live drills of any new aircraft model. I was at the last one for the Boeing 777, and now that's all done with an analysis. And as a result, we can hardly get your legs in the seat in front of you. So because there has never been a live emergency evacuation of one of these new aircraft models.
Hmm. Well, about the particular sensor we're talking about right now, Captain Rooney, I see that American Airlines, they said on Wednesday that they've reviewed data for more than 14,000 flights since that Lion Air crash 5 months ago, and they haven't seen a single anomaly related to this sensor, that they, quote, haven't had similar issues regarding the erroneous angle of attack during manual flight. So what does that tell you?
Well, I mean, it's data collection on the hundreds and thousands of flights that, you know, the airline operates on a daily basis, not just American Airlines, but Southwest Airlines, United Airlines, the operators that fly this airplane in the United States. And this flight operation quality assurance group, this is where this data goes. I mean, they look at all of this, plus the feedback that the crews provide, and it just hasn't manifested itself in anything close to what these two tragedies, you know, have resulted in. Now,
yeah.
Whether or not we've been living on borrowed time or that the systems that, you know, are in our planes, I know that, I believe at my company, they actually purchase an upgrade to that system that provides additional guidance to our crews should, in fact, they be faced with this anomaly.
Well, Captain Rooney, Jim Hall, and Lori Aratani, stand by. We're talking about next steps in the investigation into the Boeing 737 MAX aircraft. What's your question for a veteran airline pilot? He's got over 18,000 flight hours. Or the former chairman of the NTSB? This is On Point. We'll be right back.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about next steps in the investigation into Boeing's 737 MAX 8 and 9 aircraft. It's one of Boeing's fastest-selling, most profitable aircraft, and now there are none of them flying in the air around the world. We're talking today with Lori Aratani. She's transportation reporter for The Washington Post. Jim Hall also joins us. He served as chairman of the National Transportation Safety Board from 1994 to 2001, and Captain Larry Rooney is with us as well. He's the president of the Coalition of Airline Pilots Association. It's a trade association representing over 30,000 professional airline pilots at 14 airlines. He's also a captain and Czech airman at American Airlines with over 18,000 flight hours. So let's go to the phones here. Let's go to Jim, who's calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Jim, you're on the air.
Hi, Meghna. Are pilots in other countries trained in the same way or in the same place as pilots are in the United States?
It's a good question, Jim. Captain Rooney, do you have an answer to that?
Not necessarily. In the United States, under the FAA system, the minimum standard to serve as a flight crew member is the airline transport license. It's the highest licensing standard that the FAA issues with regard to pilot licenses. Requires, you know, over 1,000 hours of flying experience, up to 1,500, depending on the education that the pilot has when he gets into this program. But out of the country, there's other licensing standards that don't necessarily allow for the same level of flight time experience, that they substitute a lot of simulator time. There's the multi-pilot license, which is common over in Europe. One of the questions that, you know, kind of arose watching at some of the data that's come out of this particular crash is I saw a news story that showed the first officer had 200 flight hours. Now, whether that was total on the airplane, it was a little unclear. But the multi-pilot license is one that substitutes training for flight experience.
Uh-huh.
So 240 hours of total time, simulator and airplane, would be the minimum standard in order to license in Europe, where in the United States, That standard is much higher as far as flight time. They have to have 1,500 hours experience in the right seat of a regional jet, you know, for a regional airline before they can move to the left seat to be a captain at a regional and then on up to the major airline.
I see. Lori Oratani, though, there's the issue of overall training and flight time before a person can be in charge of a major aircraft. Then there's also the question of continuous training, because your colleagues at the Washington Post this week reported that after as we were talking about, that after the Ethiopian Airlines crash on Sunday, Boeing said it will update or would update the flight control software. But there was also a meeting back in November between Boeing and pilots associations after the Lion Air crash. And there's a really interesting quote here. It says, whatever level of training they decided on before the Lion Air crash, this is from an American Airlines pilot, it resulted in an iPad course that I took for less than an hour. A lot of pilots here at American did that course. But this pilot said the course did not cover the new MCAS system. There was nothing on the MCAS because even American didn't know about that. It was just about display scenes and how the engines are a little different, he said. That was back in November. Can you tell us more about that?
That is indeed the case. It was a very tense meeting. And even before this aircraft was up in the air and certified, there had been back and forth between pilots unions and the FAA and Boeing about how much training was required. Some of the European flight agencies had wanted to have more training, but ultimately they deferred to the FAA. It turned out that I believe it was Brazil. It was only in Brazil where the aviation authority said that they wanted their pilots to have more thorough training on the new aspects of these MAX aircraft. But that is indeed, I'm sure, something that Congress is going to be looking at when they hold hearings. And, you know, pilots are going to want to know. You know, pilots had raised alarms, and I think lawmakers and the public are going to want to know why the FAA made the decision that they shouldn't do this, and then post Lion Air, why more shouldn't have been done.
Yeah. Well, Captain Rooney, since you're, you know, our veteran airline pilot here, do you have a comment on this, on how Boeing handled the training in terms of the software update back in November?
I don't think the crews were aware of it until the accident, the Lion Air crash, at which point I know that there was training bulletins put out that better explained how the maneuvering characteristics augmentation system worked, or the MCAS system worked. We are certainly armed with that information today. We did not have it prior to, quite frankly, because I don't believe that the manufacturer shared that information with the industry until post-accident. And at this point now we do know that we have that information. As far as training it beyond, you know, the kind of the textbook version of it, I'm not aware that there's a 737-800 MAX simulator that's been built at this point. So whether or not you could get the actual hands-on from a simulator that would actually replicate that to the same level, I don't know at this juncture of actually that we even have one out there in the industry. I know they're in the process of building one, but I don't think we have one on property.
This is so fascinating, Captain Rooney. Let me just ask you a quick follow-up to that. So once a simulator like that is up and running, ostensibly every time a manufacturer makes an update to the software of the aircraft, that update would be reflected in the simulator, right?
Correct. Okay. Yes, because the simulator is, in the eyes of the FAA, considered to be the same as the airplane. When a pilot would train going through his training program, once he completed his training in the simulator, he would be licensed to fly that aircraft. They do require some operating experience in the actual airplane, but the licensing would actually occur at the last day of simulation. That's how good the simulators are.
Mm. Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to James, who's calling from Charlotte, North Carolina. James, you're on the air.
Oh, hello. I'm actually a student pilot in the McTamper A60 Blackhawk out of and for the Guard. I've noticed one thing, like throughout my training, is a lot of the airline pilots who actually have come back to our flight school that I used to go to, and they would come back from flying 737s and, you know, the big wig jets, and they would just have the lack of skills that they had received throughout their basic flight training, which is pushing the nose down in a stall, which is a loss of, which means you lose airspeed once we actually fall out the sky. But it's just I just can't imagine how we actually have gotten to the point where we have had digital like technology do basic piloting skills for us. My instructor, he was a Alaskan bush pilot. He flew like very basic old aircraft, like a Piper Cub out of an airstrip in Alaska. He always taught me push the nose down. I can't imagine a system having to do that for me, but we don't know what will have happened in the cockpit because we weren't there. But I think planes are getting too digital to the point where we actually are losing our basic flying skills.
Yeah.
And a lot of times in the general aviation industry, like the planes are the most complex, such as like the Cirrus and stuff like that. The planes are really for like people that have $500,000 to spend. It's killing people because they are literally relying on the technology too much to the point where they lose their flying skills.
Right. Well, James, I'm gonna take it back from you there, and thank you so much for your call. We've been hearing from a lot of pilots this hour. It's fascinating. Jim Hall, can I turn back to you for a couple of things? One is you've been saying consistently through this hour that you have concerns that the FAA does not have the ability to adequately oversee manufacturers like Boeing for the safety of the American public. And I'm just wondering, as Lori has been mentioning, there's very likely to be congressional investigations in the next, I don't know, weeks and months. What are the kinds of questions that members of Congress should be asking?
Well, hopefully they're going to look at the structure of FAA. As you know, we have an acting administrator. We don't have anyone who is confirmed in that position. My understanding is there's a large number of vacancies there. What is being done to maintain the competence, expertise, and integrity of our aviation oversight component of the government, to look at the certification process, and I think obviously to focus specifically on their field offices and their relationships with the airlines and with the manufacturers to ensure their hundreds of thousands of competent, well-trained people working for these, for Boeing and for other manufacturers. There's a pilots, a huge industry. It's a huge system that at the end has to support your decision to get on an airplane because you think it's safe.
Yeah. Well,
that needs a full review at this point in light of what has occurred with this Boeing 737 MAX introduction.
Yeah. Well, so let me ask you another question, Mr. Hall. I mean, you did, I'm sure, many investigations during your time as NTSB chairman. Modern-day aircraft are almost these miracles of complex technology coming together, you know, hundreds if not thousands of different systems to get people off the ground. I'm sure, haven't there been situations or past investigations where the focus initially might have been on, or at least the public's focus might have been on one particular system, but then as the investigation proceeds, it turns out that the cause of the crash was something entirely different. Is that possible in this case?
Well, it's possible. I worked for 5 years with Boeing on the longest NTSB investigation, the 737 rudder issue, which ended up with a rudder change on the entire 737 fleet.
Mm-hmm.
I experienced a tremendous lack of transparency from Boeing at that time, trying to get information to protect public safety. I did TWA 800, which was indirectly a certification issue. We had the ATR, which is manufactured by Airbus, 72 introduced into the United States, with a fatal accident at Roselawn, Indiana, that resulted in a change of the entire re-icing system. So it's only natural, it's part of our system, that manufacturers are going to look for less expensive ways to operate the aircraft and market their product. The NTSB's investigation is focused on one thing, that's safety and preventing accidents.
Right.
Almost every accident I've had initially is blamed on pilot error. That used to be the old saw. Now, where these airplane or aircraft are flown primarily by the computer, the gentleman that called in on, basic pilot training,
yeah,
I think was right on. We need to be sure there's a balance, because even on the space shuttle, if you remember, there's a pilot.
That's
right. There's a way to help on the reentry, and we saw that situation.
Right.
I just think here people were putting their weren't looking and keeping aviation safety first. That's been my whole interest in this discussion since the beginning.
Right. Well, Lori Aratani, let me turn back to you. We've got about four-ish minutes left in this conversation. And what impact is this grounding order worldwide now essentially having on Boeing? Because and I should say American and Southwest, because I'm seeing here that American and Southwest combined have about more than 70 of these 737 MAX aircrafts, but that worldwide, the global fleet is 370. I mean, I keep saying that it's the fastest selling, most profitable aircraft for a world major aerospace manufacturer. So what effect is this grounding having?
Well, this is going to have an effect on Boeing. It's not just the financial impact, right? It's the image. It's the company's reputation that's at stake here. And you've got other companies. China also is trying to develop their aviation manufacturing system as well. You know, time will tell. After the 787, there was an issue with the Boeing's Dreamliner back in 2013, where the planes were grounded for about 3 months because of concerns about the lithium-ion batteries. Boeing took a short-term financial hit, but ultimately they ended up coming out okay. So we'll have to see what ultimately happens to their bottom line, but most importantly, what happens to their reputation. This is, it is the fastest selling aircraft. You have to remember this plane has been flying since 1967. Mm-hmm. This is only the most recent version. So there are lots of versions of the 737 that are still flying out there. And yes, you're right. There are about 70 in the U.S., Southwest, American, and United all operate versions. To the MAX version of this plane. We'll see. Boeing, it is in Boeing's best interest to get these planes back up in the air. Hopefully regulators will ensure that when they're back up in the air, they are safe to fly. People can feel comfortable about flying them.
Yeah. So, Captain Rooney, on that point, I mean, what would you tell passengers in the United States and both worldwide about, I guess, the planes are grounded now, but about the safety of these aircraft and sort of flying in general?
I think that the airplane design is probably one of the safest in the world. I mean, it's got a long history of safe operation, certainly, and the crews that fly them are very well experienced in the United States, for sure. As far as the investigatory people that are there, we have the best in the world that are on site today. And there's a lot of, there will be a lot of things that will be discovered in this process. One of the things they used to train us on in accident school was don't ever fall in love with a theory, because that theory might be incorrect. And the stakes are too high to get this one wrong. So we want them to do the usual painstaking, thorough job that the NTSB does assisting today, along with the FAA over there on scene, to come back with information that will make the safe system even safer.
Mm. Jim Hall, we've got about less than a minute left to go, though. I keep hearing you saying that you're concerned about the FAA's ability to oversee passenger safety in the United States. So give you a chance for a last thought here.
Well, aviation safety, just like our U.S. government, is strongest when there's checks and balances in place. And we've got to be sure, as people that pay the bill through our airline tickets and through our taxes, that we have people smart enough to oversee and staffed enough to oversee the complicated airplanes that we're going to see in the future.
Well, Jim Hall is the former chairman of the National Transportation Safety Board, a position he served in from 1994 to 2001. Jim Hall, it's been a great pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
And Captain Larry Rooney, president of the Coalition of Airline Pilots Association, a trade association representing over 30,000 professional airline pilots at 14 different airlines. He's also a captain and a check airman at American Airlines with over 18,000 flight hours. Captain Rooney, thank you so much. It's always great to have you on the program.
Thank you, Magner. Thanks for having us.
And Lori Aratani, transportation reporter for The Washington Post, covering airports and airlines. We've got links to her reporting at onpointradio.org. Lori, it's been terrific to have you on this hour. Thank you.
Thank you.
Folks, go to onpointradio.org to give us your thoughts about safety in the airs and in the air over America and around the world, or go to Twitter and Facebook. As always, we're at On Point Radio. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices. And they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.